Okay, so it's almost the end of October, and there are like 40 phones that we've reviewed or gone hands-on with this month. But unfortunately, the month isn't over, and that means that I've brought together three people with three new phones to talk about for this, the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. It is episode 401 for Friday, October 26th. And I'm very pleased to welcome back Andrew Martinick. How you doing?
I am doing fantastic. And I wish I only had one phone.
Oh, yeah. You've got a few phones, I guess.
I think I've got like 15 on my desk right now. But they're one all gonna buzz, is top of mind.
All of them at the same time.
Like just don't send me any messages.
Okay, I'll try. Also, welcoming back to the podcast, Russell Hawley. How you doing?
Hello.
How's it been? It's been a while since you were on. I guess you were on the live show, but like, you know, since the official pod.
Everything's on fire.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, then things are normal.
Exactly.
And for the first time in, I think, 7 months, my Skype told me, Hayato Huseman, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
Hey, I'm good. I've filmed a whole bunch of phones this month, and I managed to get away with only taking one home, so I'm doing pretty good.
It's funny how we're like, no, I'm good, thanks. Somebody else can deal with that. So you are listening to this on Monday, October 29th, and there is a specific reason for that. It's because we have just witnessed the launch of two phones, the OnePlus 6T and the Red Hydrogen 1. Both of them, well, one of them has been announced and has been delayed, I don't know, seven times, I feel. That's the Red Hydrogen. The other one, the OnePlus 6T, we knew was coming. It's also been officially teased by the company for months and months. And we're also going to talk about the Asus ROG phone, that gaming device that is meant to take on the Razer Phone 2 and the Xiaomi Black Shark 2 and all these other gaming phones. Russell's got that in hand. And we're also going to talk a little bit about the Google Home Hub, because Russell wasn't on the pod last week and I really wanted to talk about it with him. So those are coming a bit later, but we're going to start with the dumpster fire of the week. And I talk
way to sugarcoat that one.
I talk, of course, about the Pixel 3. And I say that as somebody who just wrote an article called "The Pixel 3 is quickly becoming my favorite phone ever." So we'll run through the list of things that this phone is apparently terrible at. And we'll start with you, Russell, because I knew that you really...
I want to start off by saying that I have no problems with this absolutely perfect phone. No one has made a more perfect phone before, and that's it. That's
all. Russell has Stockholm Syndrome from this past week, because he has been at the mercy of his Twitter feed after having slightly...
I mean, aren't we all?
Not even complain. Like, you were just objectively pointing out that the speaker on the Pixel 3 makes some rice vibrate if you turn it up loud enough.
When I walk through the house and I listen to podcasts or something, and I'm doing three or four different things at the house, I usually walk around with the speaker at max volume, just kind of in my hand, listening to podcast or talking to someone on the phone or, you know, doing any of that kind of stuff. And I do this with every phone that I have ever had. And the speaker on the Pixel 3... In a way that is very similar to the G7 ThinQ
and the V40
and the V40 causes a fair bit of vibration on the back of the phone. LG calls this a feature. It is their boombox mode. If you set it on a cardboard box or some other flat surface, it makes the ambient noise louder with some clever resonance tricks, which is a neat little trick. But it also takes any amount of bass or spoken word, which I get a lot of in podcasts, which people listening also get a lot of in podcasts, and it causes this vibration on the back of the phone exactly where my fingers sit. And I said that bugged me. It drives me a little crazy walking around and feeling this. And the immediate response was that it wasn't that bad. you know, that I was just making it up and that it wasn't, you know, that this was just kind of not a big deal. And to be fair to the people who said that initially, this was on the heels of all of the other stuff we're going to talk about in this beginning thing, which is, you know, the Pixel came out, so people are nitpicking every little thing, which happens with every phone, by the way. But the phone vibrated a little bit. It didn't make me happy. I said something on my own Twitter account, which was against the rules. And so to demonstrate that I wasn't just making this up, I recorded a 10-second video. I just like grabbed the first thing that I had near me, which just happened to be the 12-pound container of jasmine rice in my kitchen. And I sprinkled some on it and recorded it. And the rice like goes nuts. Like it spins around and does this. No other phone that I had on my desk generated the same result. So I'm clearly not making up the vibration. It's just whether or not it bothers you. And no, not everyone even in my house thought that it was a problem.
What you clearly did was you created a small motor.
It's all Photoshop.
Yeah. And you put it underneath the desk as it was vibrating so that it just made the mice look like
this. This is not a thing that I enjoy. It's not my favorite feature. If I had the ability to turn it off, I would. It does not make me want to not use the phone. It's just an irritation. And it's something that not everyone agrees is a problem. Like I handed the phone to my partner. I handed the phone to my son. I was like, check this thing out to make sure that I'm not crazy. And there were a couple of people in my immediate social circle who were like, yeah, I don't really like that. Like my phone doesn't do that. I don't really dig that. But equally as many people that I handed the phone to, like, enjoyed it. Like, you know, that's actually kind of cool. It feels like the phone is you know, louder than it is. And that's a sensation that's not uncommon. We live in a world where people sell special mats that you attach to the back of your gaming chair to cause, you know, the vibration that you hear from your games to you know, flow through your body.
The Woojer.
Right. So there are people who dig this, and I'm not one of those people. And that's all it really comes down to.
I just have to say that I'm glad that you've taken some of the focus on the Pixel 3 XL away from the notch.
And to be clear, this is just
staring at the back of the phone instead of the front.
Right. And this is just the Pixel 3. Like I don't even know if it works the same way on the 3 XL. I have not touched an XL yet.
It does.
That's, yeah, I mean, it just happens. The problem is not that it causes vibrations, because every phone has a little bit of vibration with the speaker. It's just that the vibration for this phone is exactly in the middle of the phone where my fingers rest, which is unusual. That's, you don't get that with most phones. You certainly don't get it with the Pixel 2. So it was an unusual thing for me to experience. And I thought that after a couple days, I would just kind of get over it. But I can only listen to stuff for a little while before I switch to headphones or something, because I just don't enjoy that sensation.
Yeah. So what I find so interesting is I was in Korea earlier this year to learn about the LG G7, and that feature, the resonating chamber inside the phone that makes it vibrate, which is much, much more prominent on the G7 than it is on the Pixel 3. Is a feature. Like, it is one of the things, the boombox feature, and Andrew, you can attest to this on the V40, it is the thing they put on the box. It makes the whole freaking phone vibrate, and I love it. I think it's super cool, but I'm also one of like four people on this entire planet that liked that dynamic vibration feature on the Xperia XZ2. So I guess I just enjoy the physical sensation of music. I associate it with I'm that guy who, when I'm at a concert, loves that the whole room like vibrates, right?
Yeah, like, feeling the sound when you're at a concert.
I think it's just a it's a neurological or physiological preference. And I
totally get that. Yeah, and to be clear, this same thing that bothers me about when I'm listening to music, it's that same feature in this phone is a big part of why the haptic feedback in this phone feels as good as it does.
Right.
Because of that same resonance chamber. So it's a double-edged sword, because the haptic feedback that you get from this phone is very good. I think that it is great. I hope that we see more of that. I just wish there was a way to have one and not the other. And I guess that just makes me a little picky, and I'm okay with that.
So That's one controversy. Another one is, I think, so interesting, and something that Jerry wrote a really great explainer on earlier this week. So we knew when we got the phone that it didn't charge as quickly on non-Pixel stand wireless chargers, but nobody had really measured it. It was just like, oh, that's weird. You know, my 9-watt Samsung charger charged the phone slightly in slightly longer, but I didn't measure it. And somebody did the math, and they found that it wasn't actually charging as quickly. And they reached out to the company whose 10-watt charger they bought, Anker, and Anker wrote them back and said, well, that's because Google has limited Qi charging to 5 watts on the Pixel 3. Now, Andrew, on the box, on the specs page, this says that the Pixel 3 supports wireless charging, specifically Qi charging. And it also says that it supports the Pixel stand. What we didn't know until this week was that those two things were completely separate.
Yeah, so they basically went to the lowest common, Google did, went to the lowest common denominator and said they support Qi at the 5-watt level. And then they also support the Pixel stand, which is not fully Qi compliant, but charges at 10 watts. And I think where the confusion comes from is that when you go on to Amazon and you go to look at an Anker charger, or you go to look at a Belkin charger, whatever, especially now that the last couple generations of iPhones have wireless charging, there is a huge range of wireless charging speeds. And all you see advertised is compatibility with, you know, XYZ popular model and wattage. So you see lots of 5-watt, 7-watt, 10-watt, and you even see 15-watt. Options sometimes as well. Then you see things like compatible with Samsung fast wireless charging, yada, yada, yada. So they just assume when you see the 10 watt number from random Belkin charger that it will charge as quickly as the Pixel stand at 10 watts.
Right.
And it doesn't right now.
So, yeah.
It seems.
I mean, you and I, like, we did some research earlier in the year on the Galaxy S9 because the teardown for that phone.
That's exactly what this reminded me of.
Yeah, it claimed that the phone supported 15-watt wireless charging because technically Samsung's fast charging standard, I guess, does support 15 watts, or at least the charging coil that they had put inside the phone supported it, rather. And we decided to test it by buying a couple of 15-watt chargers. I think yours was from
Ventev.
Ventev, right, that cool-looking one. Mine was from Belkin, and lo and behold, the phone did not charge any faster on those chargers than Samsung's proprietary fast, you know, 9-watt fast charger.
Yep.
So that seems to be an artificial limitation, or at the same time, it also looks like Samsung is not following the Qi spec specifically either. They're building on top of it.
And To be fair to Samsung, in one respect there, they do the exact same thing. They don't say that they support X watt, you know, whatever specific watt Qi charging. They say they support Qi and PowerMat and Samsung fast wireless charging.
Right.
And the bottom of a Samsung charger has the Qi logo on it on the back, but on the front it says Samsung fast charge. And all the fine print says you have to use a Samsung phone with a Samsung charger and a Samsung fast charge wall plug of, you know, whatever watts, because they do their own system as well.
And nobody's really impugned Samsung for this. It's just that Google messed up the marketing side of it. They didn't make it explicit that you could only achieve 10 watts on a Google branded charger, until we found out earlier this week that that's not actually the case either, that they're working with companies like Belkin to standardize and certify their own made for Google 10 watt chargers. Why would they do that, Russell? That seems a little bit of a money grab to me.
So there's two things at play here. One, the Pixel 3 on the wireless charger that I use here, and this is a mostly speculation. I haven't done a whole lot of testing on this yet. It gets kind of warm. on this wireless charger. After say like an hour, I'll pick it up off the charger and I'll notice that it's kind of warm, like warmer than, certainly warmer than my iPhone or my S9 is on this exact same charger. And I would guess that this higher wattage, threshold, probably has some pretty significant regulation that Google wants at the higher points of the battery. So like when you get to 90% higher, we've seen that with fast charging with a cable. And we're kind of in murky ground here when it comes to wireless chargers, because wireless chargers have that follow the Qi standard. They're either on or off. Like they don't do a whole lot in the way of reading what the battery percentage is and doing anything. This is really kind of a Wild West situation when it comes to most of these high-end or high-output wireless chargers.
And so, I want to quickly mention on the heat front that all of Samsung's fast wireless chargers have fans in them.
Right. So what it seems to me like would be happening here is Google is implementing a standard in which fast wireless chargers are paying attention to the battery level and will probably throttle down when we get to, you know, 90% or 95%, so that it trickle charges to that last couple percent, like we see with fast physical chargers in that same situation. It would be really nice if Google were to take this and go to the Wireless Power Consortium and say, look, we want to do this. This should be a standard. And there may be some reason for why that hasn't happened. But Google has decided that this is the right way to go, to have this made by Google standard and to charge people to kind of license that out. It sounds an awful lot like MFI certification from Apple to me. But I do understand it at the base level, kind of the reason behind it, because having these high output wireless chargers that don't pay attention to the battery when it reaches 90% or 95% can seriously decrease the longevity of the battery. And that's not a thing that we want.
Yeah. So I see that side of it as being really good motivation. Just like I was talking about how many different wireless chargers you can find just on Amazon or eBay or whatever you want to do. It's a total minefield out there. Like the wireless chargers, just go look at reviews on Amazon for wireless chargers. It is a total crap show, if you will, of different compatibilities, fast charge, standard, different wattages work with different phones. People have problems with placement. They have problems with speed and heat and different wall plugs and different cables. It is really, really bad. People think that, you know, like the kind of nerd type of people that are pointing out these differences think that, oh, it's super easy. I have, you know, four different wireless chargers and they all work great, but they don't. They never work consistently, even when you have stuff that specifically says it's certified or whatever, tested for a specific phone. It doesn't work consistently across the board. And so you can understand why Google wants to do that. The only other side of that is that Google really pushed against these kind of licensed charging systems by going all in on USB-C power delivery for its phones and saying that other Android manufacturers need to support power delivery as well. And this really doesn't follow that same idea.
To me, this is sort of similar to the way that Google sort of standardized USB-C audio, where, you know, before there were all kinds of different USB-C headphones that would come with, you know, maybe an HTC phone or, you know, whatever else, but they wouldn't really work with other USB-C devices like they were supposed to. And then Google comes out with this whole, you know, with their own USB-C standard with audio. And, you know, now they work, their headphones work with pretty much any USB-C device. I mean, Daniel, you use the USB-C buds that came with the Pixel 3 with your MacBook.
Yeah. And, you know, that to me was surprising because it's so uncommon, as you said, right? The HTC ones don't work with any other phone. And it's the same with a lot of the USB to headphone adapters, right? So you want to take for granted that when your phone supports wireless charging, it will just work. But Google, I think, is... I'm not trying to defend this because it's not really... What they did by not disclosing it until somebody found them. It's not really defensible, but I'm defending the practice of creating a superior, safer, high-speed charger that doesn't get warm, that also has all of these additional features, right? You have this Google Assistant integration, you have the ambient display, things like that, right? So the charger needs to be certified so that the screen can be on all the time, right? Most yeah. phones are not charging with the screen on 80% of the time. So that's a difference as well. The second thing is that it's not like Google is only supporting its proprietary chargers. The 5-watt Qi standard charges your phone in 3 hours. It's not like it takes 8 hours to charge your phone from zero. So it's not as fast as Samsung's fast charge. It's not as fast as anything that we would take for granted today as fast charge. But you have to remember, when Apple launched the iPhone X with wireless charging, it initially only supported 5-watt wireless charging too, and only received 7.5-watt support after the, I think, 11.1 update. It took a few months. Most phones that support wireless charging, like the LG series, anything that's not made from Samsung, they don't really advertise the speeds at which that those phones can charge wirelessly. So we just take for granted that it's like 5 to 7.5 watts because that's part of the Qi standard.
And we also kind of take for granted that, I mean, we all have modern chargers, or we use the USB-C PD ones that come in the box for wired charging. That's still just a total dumpster fire too. Like, what works? I mean, we with USB-C PD across different phones and fast charge across different phones is not consistent even in the wired realm, and that's been around so much longer. And yeah, we still have these problems.
Like, quick charge is probably way more responsible for splintering the fast charge ecosystem than anything else, right? Because Samsung, the company that sells more phones than any other on the planet, still supports Quick Charge 2.0 because all they've done is adapted their Quick Charge 2.0 spec and then modified it slightly to support its phones. There's no incentive for them to go USB PD because they have a licensing deal with Qualcomm. And I have no doubt that along with the Qualcomm Snapdragon processors as part of the license, they require some manufacturers to integrate Quick Charge. It's just probably a thing that they do. It makes total business sense.
Yay, everything's broken.
Well, we have more things.
Don't Samsung phones actually support USB PD?
They do.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm wrong about that. They do have their own quick charge-ish, even though it's pretty slow.
It supports USB-C PD at, I think, 15 watts. The last couple generations do.
Yeah.
But their quick charge 2.0 isn't even the same as 2.0 because like the Note 9 charges its larger battery just as fast as the small S9. So again, it's like you can have these things that you can point to and say it has quick charge too, or it has USB-C power delivery. But even depending on the different generations of phones with the same, ostensibly the same level of charging, and depending on what charger you use, you get different speeds anyway. It's just a whole thing that people are acting like this is a solved problem and every phone charges, at the same rate and every phone can use the same wireless chargers and Google's messing it up. And it's like, no, Google has this problem of not, really disclosing how this is working, but it's not like everyone else in the industry has it figured out.
Yeah, exactly. So that being said, I wrote this piece on the Pixel 3 being my favorite phone. I'm not going to go into it too deep because we're already too deep into this topic. But I will say that none of the issues that I've seen, I haven't seen any of the issues. I don't have any of the major problems that people are describing. But even though I understand those are present for some people, I still find this to be my favorite phone ever. And I think it's because it just doesn't try to do things that it you know, a phone doesn't need to do. It's not trying to, it's not trying to stay alive for 3 days by having a 4,000 milliamp hour battery, because I don't need that. You know, everything that I need in a phone, this does exactly, you know, almost perfectly. So, go read that if you haven't already. All right. So let's move on. Let's talk about the two new phones, that we're gathered here to talk about. Andrew, you went to New York for this event. You've been to New York for, you know, for all of the OnePlus events when they were there. You know, you're the guy who uses all the OnePlus phones before they're announced or before mm-hmm. they come out. What's your take on the 6T in terms of its significance in the product lineup, the changes from the 6, and whether or not it's going to be the most impressive or most popular phone OnePlus has made so far?
I mean, that's kind of the whole thing about OnePlus, is that its latest phone is just all you get. Like, comparing it to the OnePlus 6 is fine, I suppose, but nobody's buying a 6T if they already have a 6, and you don't have an option to continue to buy a 6 since the 6T is out. OnePlus, you know, unceremoniously just kills the old product like 5.5 months in and releases the new one. So from that perspective, you kind of get stuck in this thing of, well, you can complain about, you know, things that are different or not as good or whatever, but it doesn't really matter, because it's not like you have the option of picking something else. You have to continue to look at this in the broader market. And the thing that's really going for the 6T is that it's still super cheap. They went up by $20 again. It's $549 for the base model. But everything else in the market continues to go up at a faster rate. Samsung just released the Note 9. It's $999. The Pixel 3 XL just came out, which, you know, is the size competitor to this. It's $899. This is still $549. And so they can talk about how it's a flagship all they want, but it kind of still occupies this weird middle ground where it's $100 or $200 more than mid-range phones, we traditionally call mid-range, but it's now $200 to $300 less, even $400 less in the case of the Note 9, than the super, you know, high-end flagship phones. And so it's carved out this nice little niche where they can continue to bump up what it does and do these releases every 6 months with $20 price increases. And nobody can really complain about the shortcomings that are still all here. So the 6T was never going to introduce something entirely new. These T variants are very, very mild refreshes. But, you know, when you look at the phone, still no wireless charging, even though it has a glass back, no water resistance, you know, single kind of basic speaker, really crappy haptic feedback. Like, all these little things are still here. This isn't like monumentally different, but that means that all the good stuff is also still here. The really good spec sheet, you know, it's across the board, full spec sheet, base 128 gig storage now, really good large screen, cameras that are better and better with each generation, solid hardware, really great software performance. Those things are all still there. And so this is just a OnePlus phone, and that's totally fine. It's just not going to blow your socks off. Like, the T versions are never going to capture new people, really, that weren't already interested in OnePlus phones.
I think the coolest thing about OnePlus right now is the way that they are able to demonstrate that these things that we see as features, as like bonus features on big phones, like the 128 gigs of storage, or, you know, kind of fancy stuff that happens with the display, that these are kind of throwaway things that OnePlus is able to put in without raising the cost too much, which makes the conversation about why phones like the Note 9 are as expensive as they are makes them a lot more complicated to have when you're actually thinking about it.
Yeah, I mean, Hayato, you used the OnePlus 6 for a long time.
Yeah, it's been my main phone for a while.
And it's only five and a half months old, but what's the impression that you take away from it? I mean, you wrote like this, the OnePlus 6 is so good that you actually stopped using your Galaxy S9. And the Galaxy S9 is, you know, that's kind of the standard bearer of all Android phones, right? You have to think what Samsung does for the year. We don't really think about it all that much after it's been released. But like what Samsung does is pretty important for the rest of the mobile industry. Yes, Apple too, but like Samsung sells 20 to 40 million of its flagships every year. And yet when you look at the OnePlus 6, you're like, eh, Samsung, whatever, I'll take this.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was more of a matter of performance and just overall experience in general. And this is not so much me trying to criticize, you know, the S9 specifically, as much as it is just praising how fast the OnePlus 6 is. It basically feels like using a Pixel phone. It's very, very speedy, super reliable. And I really got tired of, you know, the S9 is not unusably slow by any means. It's still a flagship phone, but compared to the OnePlus 6's performance for, you know, hundreds of dollars less, I was pretty blown away when I decided to try the OnePlus 6 when the Pi beta rolled out. And yeah, I was pretty much done with the S9 as soon as I booted it up. It was incredibly faster.
Okay, so let's talk probably the major visual change here is the move from a capacitive fingerprint sensor on the back to an in-display fingerprint sensor on the front. For a lot of North Americans, this will be the first in-display fingerprint sensor they've used. Andrew, what is your impression of that, you know, in many cases, phone-selling feature so far?
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing because fingerprint sensors now are just, you know, it's just normal. We expect every phone over $125 or something to have a fingerprint sensor, and these capacitive components got so cheap and they're just so good, they plateaued, that it's super easy to put them in whatever phone. So now we have new differentiations of the Face ID, face unlock type stuff, and the in-display fingerprint sensors. And the one in the 6T is not as good as a capacitive sensor. I don't think there's any way to get around that. The one in the Mate 20 Pro is not as good as a capacitive sensor. The ones that Vivo's using, not as good, even in their multiple generations. The question here is whether you can actually see the positive trade-off. So you have an in-display fingerprint sensor that's optical instead of capacitive, so it has to light up the screen. It takes a little bit of time to recognize. Functionally, it works with the system and the apps totally fine. The problem is how slow it is compared to these really, really good capacitive sensors that recognize a fingerprint in 0.2 seconds or so, and at most a half a second. Whereas the optical sensor is at best a half second, and in some cases 1 to 2 seconds, it sounds like I'm complaining about 2 seconds, you know, whatever. But when you're just sitting there holding your finger on it and you're wondering whether it's going to be able to recognize your fingerprint or not, that's, you know, that extra hiccup is, it detracts from the experience when you're used to getting an acceptance or a rejection even really, really quickly on the capacitive sensor. It feels a little funky. Now, the question is, what do you get for this extra slowdown? Well, it's cheaper for OnePlus to put this little thing underneath the screen rather than cutting out a hole in the back and putting the fingerprint sensor in the back. And presumably you get a little bit more battery, which this does have a larger battery than the 6, a considerably larger battery, over 10% larger. But, you know, how much can you attribute that to the fingerprint sensor? It's hard to say. I'm okay with it. I know that Daniel maybe has other thoughts.
I don't like it. I think it's bad. I think it's a regression.
It's definitely a regression. You could tell I'm not positive about it. I'm okay with it. It works. I don't like how slow it is.
I think that this was a mistake. That's basically what it comes down to. I think it was a mistake. I think I think they needed something to sell the phone with, and they waited a long time. I mean, we talked to OnePlus before the phone came out, and they said that they were looking at integrating in-display fingerprint sensor with the OnePlus 5T, which is a year ago. So they were, that means that 2 years ago when they were developing the 5T, they were looking at that early, early technology, and it was too slow. And now they determined that it was good enough. And I think they called it a third generation sensor.
Sounds right.
Which means that this year alone, because we saw first generation sensors at CES. So this year alone, there have been three iterations of this particular technology. And like, let's actually talk about the technology, Russell, because this is, it's kind of neat, right? The way it works is that it uses a camera underneath the display, and the display itself has to be OLED because it has to be transparent enough to and thin enough to the camera sensor that it can pick up your fingerprint at a high enough resolution.
Yeah, I mean, conceptually, it's super cool to think about. Like, you know, using the sensor in this way is really clever, the way that it's kind of hidden behind the screen. And that's kind of the dream, right? We want these sensors tucked away behind the screen so that the front of the phone can be all display. That's the big complaint behind the notch, is you know, the notch is this weird stepping ground until we figure out how to successfully hide all of this stuff behind the display without causing any kind of decrease in performance. And what you guys are describing, I haven't touched the phone yet, but what you guys are describing is that decrease in performance. It doesn't sound like it's a huge decrease compared to what we've seen with like the Vivo designs, but this is kind of the clumsy step forward. We have to improve these sensors in order to move forward. And really the only way to improve them is to keep using them.
So yes, I mean, the question is whether OnePlus needs to die on that hill, or whether it should have, you know, waited out another generation, especially with the fact that they don't have to wait a year every time. You know, they could have done this with the 7 or, you know, whatever, because they have this 6-month release cycle. I mean, Daniel's right. They did need some kind of a hook. I mean, if they didn't switch to an in-display fingerprint sensor, which is a cool technology demo, the 6T is even less interesting because it really wouldn't have many changes. I put this on the same level as Samsung putting its fingerprint sensor in a completely nonsensical place in the Galaxy S8 and Note 8 series. I mean, that was a massive usability problem. Even though it was on the back and it was a capacitive sensor, that was a massive usability problem. And I think that this isn't even quite that bad, but it is bad from a standpoint of, you took something that used to work really well and you made it work less well and didn't show me what the benefit was.
Yeah. So Hayato, I mean, you've also been using the 6 for a few months, and with, you know, the 6, they debuted a really fast face unlock feature that then was backported to the 5T, and I think even 3 and 3T, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think so.
If you're using one of those phones, send me an email, podcast@androidcentral.com. And, you know, that face unlock is, you know, conversely, compared to the slower speed of the in-display fingerprint sensor, super fast. Now, does that negate the regression here, or do you still need something that's a little bit more secure?
I personally want a bit more security than that, because, you know, the face unlock on the OnePlus 6 is really just it's basically just using the camera. It's not using any kind of like depth mapping of your face like the iPhone or the Oppo Find X or anything like that. So it's not super secure necessarily. I like face unlock a lot when it comes to, you know, colder weather, say, you know, winter's coming up and I'm going to be starting to wear gloves a lot soon. Fingerprint sensors are obviously not going to work, you know, no matter where they are. So I like having it as an option, but I don't think it negates the need for a good fingerprint sensor at all.
And I think that brings up a good point there, because Like, my fear here is that complaints are going to come out as soon as people, normal people, start to use the 6T, and they're going to complain about the speed and accuracy of the fingerprint sensor. And OnePlus has already kind of gone up to the point where they say face unlock is, like, cool, even though their face unlock is really not nearly as secure as some of the advanced systems. And OnePlus is going to, reduce the effectiveness of the finger in display fingerprint sensor in order to give it more false positives or reduce the rejection rate so that it lets you into your phone more easily and speeds it up. I don't like that. And I really hope they don't do that, but I could easily see them releasing an update that's just like, fingerprint sensor is now faster, when really what they did is what we saw with early capacitive fingerprint sensors was just reduce the or increase the margin of error and just let it recognize with a lower threshold of fingerprint.
So I'm not sure that's possible given the stipulations.
Oh, it's definitely possible.
I'm sure it's.
All they have to do is reduce the percentage, like reduce the percentage of the sensor that needs to recognize a fingerprint to authenticate, and you can do it. So this is the exact same thing that happened with early Samsung phones when they switched from optical to capacitive sensors in the little bean shaped home button. They had to reduce their, so they used to have a really, really, really low false positive rate, and that meant that when you swiped on the fingerprint sensor, it just didn't work most of the time. They had to throw that out the window and have false positives in order to make it work properly with a small sensor.
Right. So what I'm saying is, you know, if that happens, you're getting a call from Google, and I don't think that, you know, with the biometrics API that's available in Android Pie, I don't think that is even that's not feasible, right? You can't, because of the way that the API works, right? You have to have a secure enclave, which it is in the Qualcomm Snapdragon 845. You store your fingerprints in there. They have to match. So my guess is, not only would you have to if they release an update, they would wipe your fingerprints from the system. So you'd have to relearn the fingerprint altogether. And if that's the case, then you're basically advertising that your technology sucks and that you have to store less or in a lower resolution the fingerprint sensor in the secure enclave.
No, I don't think that they even have to go that far. They literally have to, they could just take what the current area of your finger, the area that it requires, and just slightly reduce it. I mean, the question is whether they go to an unacceptably low level. Every other phone has they all have a different level of false positives, a different error rejection algorithm. Like, this is not 100% standardized. The question is, like, what that threshold is and whether they decide to do it in response to complaints. Because there will be complaints. The fingerprint sensor is not as good as what we're used to. And, that's kind of the problem.
All right. Well, I still think that it's just not a great piece of technology. And on the flip side, though, given the speed of the face unlock, and sometimes, if I turn on the phone in the right orientation, it's pointing right at my face, it'll unlock way before I even get to the point where I can unlock it with the on-screen display, the on-screen fingerprint sensor. And I think that's the goal, right? You use the more secure biometrics when necessary. So when you're unlocking an app or you're paying with Google Pay, and every other situation, you should feel comfortable unlocking the phone with your face. And that's the right compromise, ideally. However, I just don't think that
I get that. That's a fine compromise. But we just got done talking about how it would be unacceptable to have a lower false positive rate on the fingerprint sensor, yet we're saying that it's acceptable to unlock your phone with a camera pointed at your face that's completely foolable.
Yeah. So what I mean is it's up to the user to decide what sort of a compromise that security entails. So, you know, we've gone over this so many times about if you really want to keep your phone secure, you should use a 6-to-8-digit PIN or an alphanumeric password. Like, realistically, that's far more secure
than
any biometrics the manufacturers create. OnePlus is ostensibly saying, we're offering you a better alternative. And I'm saying, no, you're not. Because the 6 with the fingerprint sensor on the back, super fast, super reliable, plus face unlock on the front, to me, that is the best of both worlds.
So my question to you is then, does this taint the experience enough for you to not like the 6T overall? Because it definitely seems to affect your feeling of the phone more than mine.
Yeah, so I think it's good, and I think that the benefits of the bigger battery, the dewdrop notch, and yeah, that's kind of it, eh? They do outweigh it a little bit.
And it's a larger, brighter screen, too.
A larger, brighter screen, but not a whole lot brighter. And it's not that much larger either. It's like 0.7 inches larger. But Hayato, I actually want to know from you, because you're the millennial in the room. Or
Sup,
fam. You know, so this phone looks pretty lit. How lit is this phone in your estimation?
Daniel, I'm so glad you're actually a dad now, because
on a scale of 1 to 10, where 0 is completely dark and 10 is like purely lit, where does this, you know, phone fall on that?
We're just going to keep going down, aren't we?
How do you do, fellow kids?
Where is the bottom on this conversation?
Oh, it was a long time ago.
I don't know, though. I mean, to me, I think the fingerprint sensor being under the display, I think that makes the phone less appealing than the 6, honestly. I know it leads to a bigger battery and all kinds of other things, but, you know, to me, the battery life on the OnePlus 6 was outstanding. That wasn't an issue to me at all. So I don't really think it's worth that sacrifice. So, you know, looking at it coming from the OnePlus 6, you know, the way I see it, I'm just going to get slower authentication, a bigger battery that I'm probably not going to notice unless I'm just really abusing my phone that day. I don't really think it's a very good upgrade in my eyes.
And we can also note that there's no headphone jack on this phone.
There is that too.
How dare you?
Okay, it comes with a really nice dongle in the box.
Yeah, the dongle is red. It's the most red dongle I've ever seen.
It's pretty lit.
Russell, so I think we're going to save sort of the most interesting. I think the most interesting aspect of this phone has nothing to do with the phone itself. And I want your take on it. So this phone is the first device that OnePlus has sold to be officially available at a carrier in the US. It's going to be available at T-Mobile on November 1st. We're not sure of the pricing as we're recording this, but if it's $549 MSRP unlocked, you can presume it'll be similar to that, and they'll be available on, you know, T-Mobile One. There are many kind of financing options.
They're already hyping the trade-in deals and the financing choices.
So this is a big deal for OnePlus, not to mention that this is also the first OnePlus phone to be certified, but not officially available at Verizon. So how important are those two things for the company?
I think they're huge. I think it tells us two things. One, it means that OnePlus's manufacturing system is such that they can actually produce way more than they've been able to in the past. Because as you'll remember, OnePlus has not always been super great about having a ton of these phones available at launch. So that's an exciting thing. And it's also it's going to mean that a lot more people are going to have just access to this phone, you know, because there are just a lot of people who don't even consider shopping online for a phone. These people walk into stores and they look at someone and they say, I need a new phone. And so The person behind the desk is the person who tells them what phone is new and exciting. And one thing I will say about T-Mobile employees, especially in the stores that I've been to, they really get excited about kind of cool niche phones when they hit their stores, especially when they do things that are interesting. And so
I used to work for T-Mobile, and I thought you were about to say something real negative about T-Mobile employees.
No. Anytime I've gone into one of their stores and I've been like, you know, hey, what do you think about this phone? They're typically pretty knowledgeable when it comes to, kind of what would otherwise be considered obscure phones, and they get excited about phones that, you know, aren't really available anywhere else. And so being able to say, you know, this is a really cool phone, it competes with these other phones, and you're basically only going to get it here, I think is going to excite T-Mobile employees to a point where we're going to see them kind of suggest this phone more than they otherwise would. And I think that that's going to be a really good thing for OnePlus.
I actually agree with you there, especially if you're walking into a store and your two choices are an iPhone or a Galaxy, because that's what most people know. And the store employee is like, by the way, I have this amazing phone. It has almost no notch. It has, you know, this, it looks, the screen's huge, battery lasts forever, and it's half the price of an iPhone XS or a Galaxy Note 9 or, you know,
well,
$300
you're getting
less.
Excited about the specs. I guarantee you, people who don't care about security are going to see this in-screen fingerprint thing as cool shit. When someone goes, oh, where's the fingerprint sensor on this thing? And the guy at T-Mobile smiles and then sticks his thumb on the screen and it just unlocks. Like, there are going to be people who are going to buy a phone immediately because of that. Like, people who just don't pay attention to the stuff that we pay attention to, like, they're going to see that and go, wow, that's cool. I want that.
I was going to ask, do you think OnePlus would have done the in-display fingerprint sensor if it were not for this carrier launch? Because I kind of feel like that was kind of the deciding factor is, you know, we have to make it stand out with exactly what you just said. Like, we need something that's just like, you know, going to wow customers right in the store immediately.
I think they just needed something just in general. I mean, like I said earlier, without the in-display fingerprint sensor, they don't have a whole lot going for them, to be able to lean on and say, oh, look at all this new stuff. But when it's going
in a smaller notch, that's enough for Twitter.
Well, true. You should be no notch ever. Okay. But I mean, going into T-Mobile for the first time when it's going to be exposed to a lot of people that have no real reference for what a OnePlus phone is anyway, I don't think that they needed the in-display fingerprint, but they, you know, it's just one more thing for them to lean on. But I think that the biggest thing is the price, like Russell said.
The price is interesting, right? Because $550 is not, it's not a ton of money, but it's still a chunk of change. But when you distill it down to a monthly payment of like $20, it's a lot easier to stomach than, you know, the $35-$40 a month that you would spend with any other flagship right now. And I think that's also going to be a big deal. I also know that a lot of Americans are on Verizon. And this is the first OnePlus phone that you'll be able to buy unlocked and just put your Verizon SIM in it and it'll just work. And that could be just as important as T-Mobile selling this in their stores.
It's important to me as a Verizon customer who very much enjoys just sticking SIM cards in phones and letting them work.
Yeah, I don't think it opens up a massive, you know, swell of people that can buy the phone, but it just removes one more barrier from OnePlus being in the conversation. When you get a few people together, you're most likely going to have one or two of them that are on Verizon just based on how many customers they have. And you keep them from just tuning out on OnePlus automatically as soon as they hear that it doesn't work on their carrier. Even if they never intend to use the 6T, it opens up the idea that they could use a OnePlus phone on Verizon, and now you would hope that OnePlus would consider continuing to do the certification for future phones, and they're just no longer immediately out of the conversation when you talk about buying an inexpensive phone to bring to your carrier.
The last thing I want to talk about with this phone, Andrew, is something that, you know, you've seen the box, right? this box has so much about the community, about the phone being more than just a phone. This is the CEO, Pete Lau, talking to the buyer directly, being like, thank you for buying this. Thank you for being a part of our journey. You're now a part of this group of people that never settle. How much of that do you think plays into this ongoing narrative of OnePlus being not just an enthusiast phone, but sort of like a gathering of a particular way of thinking of a particular kind of phone user?
Well, it just sets it's OnePlus setting a super high standard for itself, because I mean, we've seen in the past that's made some really dumb decisions and been very quick to go back on them and change them after public, while their little slice of the public outcry over things. And it just shows that they're really interested in this tight group. Like, they know that even if they go to T-Mobile and they sell phones to people that are just looking for a cheaper phone to use on Verizon, that even though they're doing those things, they're trying to reassure the people that have been there for years and years buying this totally unknown phone from an unknown company that they're still like the core of their philosophy of how they do phones. And when you look at the OnePlus 6T, it has lots of mainstream appeal, but really the fundamentals of this phone are still rooted in the kind of people that are on the forums getting into the nitty gritty of the beta releases and don't want the bloatware, and they love the huge spec sheets and all that kind of stuff. And they love to complain to Russell about how he doesn't know what he's talking about with speakers, or complain to me about, I don't know what I'm talking about with notches or whatever. OnePlus knows that.
How do you
that's
not know
there.
What you're talking about with a notch? It's like, it's right there. It's a notch.
Is it though? Is it there?
Just don't look over here. Look at the in-display fingerprint sensor. There is a notch on the OnePlus 6T, but that's their core group of people. And I think that they're just trying to reassure those people. I'm not sure how much it's really going to, opening this up and having a little handwritten, but screen printed note from the CEO that says, thank you so much and welcome to the family kind of thing. I don't know how much that's really going to convince anybody to stick with the OnePlus phone. The important thing is both reassuring the people that have been there for a long time and then just having a good product. That's what the normal people want. They just want a good product that doesn't give them any headaches. And that's way more important than some messaging about how you're part of the community.
Like, all I'm saying is that if Pete Lau really cared about me, he would have put a better haptic engine in this thing.
Oh my God, it's so bad.
It's so bad.
I'm going to complain
so
about
bad.
It on Twitter.
It's so bad. Oh my God. Okay.
is it worse than the OnePlus 6, or are you just
no? It's the same. It's the same identical motor. Like, there's no change.
That's a shame.
I was so hopeful. I was like, oh, you have these, like, there's so few things from the 6 to improve. You know, the notch didn't bother me. The camera was pretty good. I mean, we haven't even talked about the camera on this phone. It's the same thing.
It's
identical
good.
Specs. Except there's a new night mode, which will come to the 6. So, it's fine.
Takes good photos. It's a fine camera. But the haptics.
Yeah, God. Anyway. All right. Any last words on the 6 or 6T before we move on? Because I'm so excited to talk about this thing Hayato's dealing with. You are kind of dealing with it.
Suffering.
Yeah, a little bit.
All right. Let's take a quick break. Let's talk to our friends at Thrifter. Every week we want to highlight a few deals at thrifter.com, because Thrifter is the place to go for your tech deals, your home deals, your health and fitness deals, and even your coupons and your gift cards. There's been a lot of really great discounts on gift cards this week. I didn't know this was a thing, that like retailers sell discounted gift cards.
Oh yeah. This is a big deal, especially this time of year.
So Thrifter is the place that rounds all of these things up. As we do every week, we go round the horn and we pick a deal that we like. I'm going to start with you, Hayato, because you're lit.
So I've been playing my Switch a whole lot lately, ever since the most recent Nintendo Direct just got me super excited about it again.
Yes.
So SanDisk has a 400 gigabyte micro SD card that is $60 off. It's only $100 for 400 gigs. You know, it's almost half a terabyte in your
hand.
That's
insane.
Yeah. I mean, pretty much no phones use these anymore. So if that's what you're buying it for, this may or may not really be that useful. But, you know, for me with my Switch, I'm really excited to get a bigger card like that that's going to fit a lot more games, because I've bought so many in the last couple of months.
Russell, what's your pick?
Okay, so these I'm actually using these headphones right now. I hadn't told anybody that I had them yet. Taltronics makes these Bluetooth headphones that have active noise canceling in them. They are normally like $60, and they're actually $45 right now on sale. These are pretty decent Bluetooth headphones for $45. They are the active noise canceling is actually really good in these. The top band can actually be flexed out to whatever head size you have. The padding on the cups is really nice. The sound is a little quieter than I'm used to, but they are otherwise really good headphones that I'll probably be talking about in greater detail on Android Central within the next week or two. But if you are looking for decent, not like mind-blowingly good, but decent Bluetooth headphones that actually have decent active noise canceling, Taltronics for $45 is a really hard deal to beat.
Very, very cool. I like when headphones are cheap and also not garbage, because those two things don't often intersect. Andrew, what's your pick for the week?
I've been eyeballing having a robot vacuum in the apartment. And I see that I love buying refurbished things because it saves money and I don't really care about them being new. There's a refurbished Roomba 650 for only $190. I thought these things were much more expensive, and this one is really well rated, down from 240 to 190. I like the sound of that.
And you can tape knives to the top of it and put balloons around your apartment, and it will pop the balloons as it cleans.
And also cut my ankles.
And also cut your ankles.
You have a bunch of you have a dog and a bunch of kids at home, Russell. So
So it's actually really funny. I had this exact machine when I first brought our dog home, and she's this little tiny Sheltie, and was terrified of this thing for the first couple months, but then like started playing with it like it was another pet in the house. And eventually it died. Like, I actually burned the motor because my kids leave stuff on the floor, and it was a sad day. But I actually like scarred my dog for life by only using this robot vacuum, because when I busted out like my big actual Dyson vacuum, the little vacuum that she had become used to turned into this giant, monstrous, louder vacuum. And she was terrified of it. But by that point, she was already like 9 months old, and there was nothing I could do about it.
Poor pups.
So if you get a robot vacuum and you have a pet, you have to have the robot vacuum for the entire pet's life. That's the rule.
Mm. Okay.
You can't switch.
It becomes another part of the family.
That's right. It's another part of the family.
All right. If you're interested in learning more about all of these great deals, head to thrifter.com, sign up for their newsletter, and go to their Twitter profile at Thrifter Daily. While you're there, sign up for the new regional newsletters. There are two. One for Canada, one for the UK. And you can do that by going to thrifter.com/CA or thrifter.com/UK.
Oh, you know what? I lied. I'm going to add a second one real quick. Okay. I'm so sorry that you got to the end of the ad. I just saw this. It's actually way more important. So these get discounted at various points throughout the year, but usually not this early. The Star Wars Advent calendar for this year is $34. They're usually 40. They are going to be like 40 or 45 when you walk by and see them in Target. Like, people who get their kids the Lego Star Wars Advent calendar, you should seriously buy it now, because the chances of you finding it for less than $40 in a month when you're actually remembering to look for these calendars is going to be really hard to come by. And the Lego Star Wars one actually looks really cool this year. So yeah, I'm actually buying that right now.
Okay, well, buy through the link, so, you know.
No, I'm going to buy it on my own. How dare you?
Fine. All right, let's talk about this crazy 4D phone, Hayato. Tell us about the Red Hydrogen 1, because this was announced in 2017. It was delayed and then delayed again. It had a price of like $1,300, $1,500. There's a titanium version. It sounds insane, and it's finally coming out. It's going to be available at AT&T and Verizon later this fall. What is the big deal with this device?
Well, first of all, it's called 4V, not 4D, which is clearly much more catchy or something.
What's the V stand for?
View.
View? Okay.
Yeah, 4V.
Fine.
Oh. Yeah. So this is probably the most excited I've ever been to receive and review a phone in the last couple of years. Not really because it's necessarily an amazing phone, but really just because it's so different. It's so, you know, just my review notes on this phone are just so long because there's so much to talk about with it. And as it turns out, sort of unsurprisingly, it's not that good of a phone, and you probably shouldn't buy it.
I am shocked.
Yeah. Womp womp. But it is still a really interesting phone. I mean, the first thing I noticed as soon as I took it out of the box was that it's just, it's built so well, and it just feels very, very much like a Red product.
It's a hefty phone.
It is. It's so big and heavy, and I've just been talking all month about how I want the Pixel 3 because I just want to go back to a smaller phone coming from the OnePlus 6.
I'm afraid of dropping this phone, not because I'm going to break the phone, but because I'm going to break whatever this phone hits.
Absolutely.
Like it's a hefty phone.
And I don't know how much it actually weighs. I haven't gotten the specs, but it's a monster.
That's like a deliberate feature. Like if you listen to Jim Jansen, like the overlord creator of Red, talk about this phone, he rails against how similar all of the phones right now look and feel, and how everyone's going towards these like lighter, thinner, you know, more fragile designs. The fact that this thing is built like a brick shit house is a feature to him, and he loves it.
Yeah. And you know what? If it were, I'm not a fan of giant phones, but at the same time, this thing feels so cool that I kind of just want to use it anyway.
But well, and part of that's like because of the outside, like there's all of this texture over the phone. It's not like
the back is split into like Kevlar on some sides and this like metal, like heatsink looking kind of backing in the middle. Like it's wild. It's got these super grippy little.
It feels good to run your finger against. It's really interesting how texture plays into that.
Yeah, it's got these like there's super grippy, ridges along the sides. Like so, it's really easy to hold onto. It's like grasping brass knuckles or something. It's insane.
But this thing looks like it was released in 2011.
And it works like a phone released in 2011 as well.
Sad.
Go on.
It's so as Daniel said, they announced it back in 2017, last year.
July 2017. Just in case anybody needs to know, again, it's October 26th, 2018.
And they haven't changed anything. So, I mean, it's when it was announced, it had the cutting edge Snapdragon 835. It's been a year and almost a year and a half, and it's still got that 835 that's not so cutting edge anymore. And the phone, it just, you know, the second you turn it on, you look at the front, and it's already got pretty sizable top and bottom bezels. But then you turn on the screen, and you realize that even on the display glass, there's a pretty thick black border around the actual display. So really, despite this phone being so large and imposing, and it's much, much bigger and taller than my OnePlus 6, the screen is a lot smaller. So it's something to get used to, but that's really not so much an issue to me as the performance is. Everything about this phone is just, it's stuttery, it's slow, it's unresponsive, and
I know that you're in the Midwest, but find the nearest large body of water and throw it in there. This is so, like, everybody saw this coming. Even people that don't know that this phone exists saw this coming. It was never going to have good performance. It was never going to have good software. It was always going to be a gimmick. Like, this is just insane to me.
But this phone was made by Red, So it's got to have like a really killer camera on the back, right?
So the cameras are actually pretty good. I've been really impressed with the camera as far as low light performance and you know, pretty much any situation. Of course, the low light's not going to be as good as, you know, say night sight on the Pixel 3. But this is obviously just the raw image from the camera. It's not doing any kind of crazy processing to make it better in low light. It does really well. There's good dynamic range. There's you know, Red's color science is sort of in play. So I've taken a couple of pictures alongside my friend who had an iPhone XS, and the colors were very different. But I actually preferred the colors coming out of the Hydrogen 1. The thing that, you know, sort of the big feature with the phone that they've been touting is this 4V thing, which is basically just glasses-free 3D. And, you know, Russell, you went to the event. They sort of made a big deal there about how it's so much better than, you know, other glasses-free 3D tech, like, say, the Evo 3D or the Nintendo 3DS or
phones anything like that. Literally 6 years old.
And it looks just like an Evo 3D. As far as my memory is recalling, it's
definitely
very
better than the Evo 3D. But the problem is it causes the same parallax shifting effect.
Yeah,
and that's what makes it feel so similar. So the reason that this gets called 4View is the way that the auto stereoscopic effect is generated is it's four panels that are all, you know, operating in different depth effects against this kind of shallow layer on the screen. And when you stare at the center of that screen and the phone is like perfectly pointed at you, you get this really neat 3D depth effect that kind of blurs out towards the edges. So it's hard to focus on the entire display. But that whole effect breaks if you tilt the phone in any one direction. You start to see one part of the panel kind of rise up over the other.
Mm.
And so like moving with the phone while you are trying to watch this 4View effect is really painful to the eye.
It is.
And so that is why it feels so similar to the Evo, because the Evo had a very similar effect when you moved the phone around, but it is functionally superior. It just unfortunately doesn't matter if it causes the same eye irritation.
So the only way to view when can you use the 4View? Is it only for images taken with the phone, or is it applying this to other things?
So it's only with images and videos. You can shoot 4View video as well. And then Red has its own Hydrogen network, which is basically just sort of like a Vimeo or a YouTube, or, you know, it's a sort of social network where you can share 4View content with other Hydrogen 1 owners, you know, all 15 of them. And, they've got a couple of preloaded content, on here. There's some videos from various, various media companies, and the first 10,000 people who buy the phone, AKA everybody who will ever purchase this phone in you know,
damn,
all of history, will get Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them and Ready Player One for free.
In 3D.
In
4View.
4V 3D view.
And then there's also, the store is going to also have The Hobbit. The entirety of The Hobbit. And the reason that is important, that it is worth mentioning, is that The Hobbit was one of the first films shot specifically for autostereoscopic 3D in a higher frame rate than we normally watch movies in.
It's also a terrible effect. Like, I hated watching
it. It was
Hobbit.
Not an enjoyable effect in theaters, where you had to wear the glasses and the greater frame rate actually caused some other visual discrepancies, like fake things looked obviously fake when they were in this kind of higher frame rate, like fake rocks in the scene looked obviously fake. It wasn't very good, but because this is such a smaller screen, you're not going to really notice that as much. So that's kind of cool. It's also going to, it's not going to be available at launch, but you're also going to be able to share 4View content to Facebook. But if you don't have a hydrogen phone, then you won't get the effect. But if you have, you don't have to use the hydrogen network. You can post things to Facebook. And if you are friends with other hydrogen users, you'll be able to see the four-view effect.
Right. And you can also text people through the Verizon Messages app, which...
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah, how many people are going to do that? But if you choose to, you can just natively text them.
Hang on a second. I just want to make sure that I say this out loud. The phone that is being sold directly through AT&T will allow you to send messages in 4View through the Verizon Messages Plus app.
So this only applies to the Verizon model, as far as I'm aware, awesome. Not the AT&T one. And again, only amongst people who own the phone.
Hang on a second. So, Russell, when you were at the launch event, like, were there questions about how many phones this company expects to sell, given it's a $1,300 entry point?
Oh yes, I have audio recording of this. It's actually kind of exciting. Jim Jansen took to the stage for about a half an hour and talked about his journey to how he got to where he was and how he was surrounded by people his entire professional career who told him that he was never going to be successful with Oakley, because if you didn't know, he is the founder of Oakley, that was never going to be successful with Red, and he is the founder of Red, and both of these things were tremendously successful, and there was other parts of his life where he encountered the same thing. And he said that when he wanted to make this phone, he said the same thing to the people who told him he was crazy about making a phone that he did when he started Red, which was, we only have to sell 0.5% of what Samsung sells to be successful.
Successful or profitable?
They're not even anywhere near 0.5%.
What he said, and Hayato has the recording as well. If we sell 0.5% of what Samsung sells, then I will consider this a success. That was his speech.
I don't even know what to say to that.
Have we done the math on how many phones Samsung sells and what 0.5% of that?
But I'm so pretty sure that Andrew's doing it right now.
Okay, so 0.5% as a 0.005 times, let's just conservatively say 50 million phones, which is like Galaxy S9s over the course of a year. So that's 250,000 phones. Red does not have a snowball's chance in hell of selling even 1/10 of that number.
No, and they really probably shouldn't. This is not... If this phone were half the price, I would still not recommend it to almost anybody. Camera performance aside, and it's not even, any other flagship phone is going to do just as well as this. So camera performance aside, this is going to be a bit mean, but it's also kind of true. The Moto E5 that we checked out a few months ago performs better than this does.
Oh. So you're telling me that a company that makes phones made a better phone than a company that's not
the price.
And if I remember the back of this phone has Pogo pins that are very similar or identical to the ones that are used in Red cameras. And that was on purpose, right? Like the intent here is to sell modules that will do other trickery things with cameras and then also be able to connect to Red cameras to act as a display.
Right. And we've seen, right? Yeah. And we've seen blueprints as far as, they've had plans on making entire shoulder rigs with this where you can have, a lens attachment so you can, or a lens mount attachment. So you can, put on whatever other lenses you might have that would go on an actual dedicated camera. You can, have a shoulder rig and basically everything that would go onto a real Red camera. And I distinctly remember Jim Jannard saying when they first announced the phone that the Hydrogen One's cameras will outperform any cell phone, any mirrorless camera, anything that's not a Red camera. This will do better. And that is at the moment just not true in any way. I should say that this is very much still pre-release software that I'm working with. And, you know, there are certain features that are just missing. There's no pro mode on the camera right now. That's supposedly coming before the phone is officially released. But, you know, at this time, I don't have pro mode to do anything with. The camera app is very lacking in settings. There's no settings menu. That's just whatever iconography is on the screen is all you can tweak. There's a lot here that just, it's not only not beating other cell phones, but it's not even competing with them as far as flexibility with the camera. There's a lot of work to do.
I'm not even sure. Like, yeah, the guy made two successful companies, but the hubris that I'm hearing from Jim Jensen is like, it's pretty audacious. Like, he clearly has no idea how difficult it is to make a phone, especially a good phone, the first time around.
Yeah. Well, let's not forget that, you know, after the Titanium model was even further delayed, they had to promise that they would give out anybody who pre-ordered a Titanium model, they'll give them the aluminum model first for free, and then they still get the Titanium one later.
So you're saying that they're eating the cost of a $1,300 phone.
Right. And I'm wondering if that's factoring into how many devices they have to sell to be successful.
I mean, I think that they're eating the cost of 95% of the phones that they're going to make, because they're not going to be sold.
It boggles my mind. So let's like, all right. So the phone, what I find so fascinating is that the phone will actually be available at two carriers in the U.S. Like, it's really hard. Even the Pixel is only available at one carrier in the U.S.
I don't think you can actually buy it from Verizon. Can you?
I thought it was being sold by Verizon.
It's being sold by AT&T. I think you can buy it and put it on Verizon.
Right.
I could be wrong.
Okay. Maybe that's fair. I thought it was being sold by both, but maybe it was just certified for Verizon.
I think a large part of why it's even being offered on AT&T is because, if I'm remembering right, AT&T owns Warner Brothers, correct?
They do now, yeah.
Or has a stake in them. So, you know, the Red has been doing a lot of collaboration with Warner for, you know, for providing a lot of 4V content for the phone. That's why you can get some of these movies just, you know, already formatted for 4V on the phone. It's I feel like that sort of partnership is sort of in play as far as why AT&T of all carriers is choosing to sell this.
Yeah, that makes sense, actually. I mean, that is interesting, though, because the AT&T Time Warner deal only went through recently, like this past summer, and the phone was announced for AT&T much earlier than that. But the deal was ongoing for quite a lot longer than that. So that is a really good point, you know, that AT&T is probably trying to sweeten the deal a little bit. Plus the relationship with Red cameras in Hollywood. It's something to think about. So anything else? I mean, how's the software? What's going on with that?
It's basically running a stock version of 8.1. Although it does have Red's own custom launcher on here, which is pretty close to stock, but it also feels very much, you know, you can read the review and I'll have more details on this, but it's very much, There's a lot of holdovers from much older versions of Android, some of which are kind of nice. You can change the animation style of, you know, switching between home screens if you're into that sort of thing. I'm really not. But there's little things like there is that the home screen tips widget from like 2011 on you know, like a Froyo phone. With a little Android that you can just tap, and it has all these very old school little tips on how to use a cell phone for the first time. There's little things like that. And I've just been noticing that, especially in Red's launcher, is sort of the source of most of the laggy performance, and you know, just opening a folder of apps is just incredibly choppy. You get maybe 10 frames in the entire animation of it opening and closing, and there's all kinds of problems with their home screen app. There's plenty of other issues within the rest of the software if you're using pretty much any other app, but I've noticed the worst hiccups in Red's own home screen.
I don't even know what to say. This phone shouldn't exist. Just shouldn't exist.
Now you got it.
All right. So last but not least, Russell, I wanted to talk a little bit about this last week and we didn't get a chance. The Home Hub, you love it. You said it's one of the best near perfect products that you've ever reviewed. Give us like the 30-second elevator pitch on why you would want this over, say, a Lenovo Smart Display or a JBL Link or something else, maybe an Echo Show. But you know why you should buy this instead.
Oh man, that's super easy. So this takes all the stuff that is cool about the Lenovo Smart Display and the JBL and the others that are coming out soon, and cuts the size and bulk at least by half in most cases. It's just an insanely compact and small design in a couple of really neat colors with this perfectly tuned display. The display has this ambient light sensor that matches the room that you're in just super, super well. And when you're not using it, dims to a point where the screen actually looks like a photo, which is really cool given that one of its big features is kind of this photo frame mode where it cycles through things. It really just legit looks like there's a photo in this frame. It does all of the same voice command stuff that all of the Google Assistant, Google Home things do. The microphones are really good. And there's no camera, so you can actually feel comfortable putting this in a bedroom or somewhere and not have to ever be concerned that there's a camera you're not comfortable with pointed at you. And that's a little more than 30 seconds.
Beautiful. Yeah, I can't wait to try it. Looks incredible. You have two now, right? Because you ordered the mint one?
I ordered the mint one, and my only complaint about the mint one is that the color stops on the bezel, which means when you are looking at it straight on, it looks exactly the same as the white one. Because the front of this thing is white. So,
yeah, and that's fair because it needs to kind of blend in with everything.
Right.
Guys, it's been a marathon, an hour and a half.
We've gone far longer before.
No, we did a two hours a few weeks ago. No, I'm just saying it's been, you know, an hour and a half is basically like if we don't hit an hour and a half, it's not a real ACP, right? It's not.
Yeah.
We haven't done it right.
It's an enjoyable marathon.
But it is Friday night here. We are recording this so that you'll be listening to it on Monday so that you can hear about all of our thoughts on the OnePlus 6T and the Red Hydrogen 1. And I know that y'all have a lot more work to do, so I'm so sorry. I'm just sorry. But Hayato, Andrew, Russell, thank you so much. Any big weekend plans?
Yes.
Anything crazy? What are you doing, Russell?
Smithsonian Institute of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. has a presentation all weekend on Dia de los Muertos.
Day of the Dead?
Yes. And it is this whole wing that they have dedicated to all this incredible artwork from Day of the Dead celebrations all across South America. And so I am going to go and see that tomorrow. Very excited.
Very cool.
Well, I can't do that because I live thousands of miles from you, so... in support of what you're going to be doing, I am going to watch Coco tonight because it's one of my favorite Pixar movies.
It's exactly
ever.
The same thing. Yeah, you've nailed the experience.
Good film.
Oh, good. Okay, fine. Sitting on my couch eating popcorn. Sounds perfect. All right, guys, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. If you're listening to this, thank you for sticking with us for 400 and now 401 episodes. We really, really appreciate it. If you have any feedback, send us an email at podcast@androidcentral.com. Hit us all up on Twitter @AndroidCentral. You can find all of our individual accounts on the website as well. Thanks for listening.
And if you think you can do what we do, send me an email, russell@androidcentral.com. I am always looking for people who are interested in writing.
Oh, you didn't mean stumbling?
No, so stumbling through a podcast is something anybody can do. That really is something anybody can do. But if you
particularly unique,
if you like the kind of stuff that we write on the site and you kind of want to give it a try, send me an email, russell@androidcentral.com. I would love to talk to you.
Have a great week. Goodbye.
Bye.
See ya.